Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk." And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads and seven mountains on which the woman is seated, they are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. And for the beast that was and is not, it is an eight, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they are the beast. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over the royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth."
Let me invite you to open to Revelation 17 once again. You'll find that page 1037 in the Pew Bible. Revelation is so strange. I would really encourage you to have a Bible open in front of you so that you can be sure I'm not making this up. This chapter is something. I want to start by pointing out Revelation is the last chapter in the book because it brings us all the way to the end of all things. It gives us the Christian vision of paradise. And it tells us how God intends to get us there. And one of the things that, at least in our culture, is particularly surprising about how God intends to get us there is that the pathway to paradise leads directly through judgment, through destruction. That's deeply countercultural. Because we live in a society that increasingly believes peace would come if we all would just be nice to each other. And I'm not trying to scorn that idea. To some extent, it feels plausible. You get to know your neighbors, they're nice people. And it seems like that should work all the way around the world. The problem with that idea is, what underlies it is, it assumes that there's no such thing as real evil in the world. And if there were, the main way to combat it would be to rehabilitate it through education or a conversation or good healthcare. Our text for today suggests otherwise, right? According to Revelation 17, real evil does exist, and it often portrays itself as luxurious and beautiful and sophisticated, but in the end, it devours and destroys. And so God deals with it, not by managing it, but by destroying it forever. And that's not even the most surprising part. The best part is the way that he does it, the way that he destroys what Revelation 17 calls Babylon the Great. That's in verse 5. Babylon the Great, verse 5 says, is the mother of prostitutes and earth's abominations. If you've ever wondered where prostitution and abomination come from, here you go. It started with Babylon. The city is pictured as a whore. She's seated on many waters and carried around by a monstrous beast. That's a preview. The chapter unfolds in three sections, and the ESV breaks it exactly right, I think, with those paragraph breaks. Verses 1 through 6, about halfway through verse 6, is the splendor of Babylon. The rest of verse 6 down to 14 is the power behind Babylon. And then 15 to 18 is the fall of Babylon. So here's the deal, friends. If you're starting to feel comfortable living in Babylon, which is where we live, according to the Bible, this chapter is meant to wake you up. Her victims fall not to her power, but to her seduction. That's where Babylon gets everything that comes to her. Or this, if you're growing tired of the fight, you're always resisting, you feel like you're always straining, this chapter will strengthen you. And if you're not even a Christian, this text explains why the world can never just heal itself, why we need an intervention from outside of us, why we need a powerful, definitive intervention. The book of Revelation calls it the Lamb who comes and conquers, destroying evil by his judgment, his wisdom, and his cross. That's what Revelation 17 is about. So let's look at it. The splendor of Babylon. Just start in verse 1. Let's just read that. Then one of the angels, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls, came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters." Now, just stop there. Let me observe that this angel is inviting John to something that's been like announced twice already in the book. Chapter 14, verse 8, you can see it on the page where you are, right above this chapter in verse 19, 16, 19, we're told that Babylon falls, that God remembered her and made her drink the cup of the wine of his wrath. Now this angel tells John he's actually going to witness it happening. But here's something. As always, Revelation defies our expectations. You don't see the vision. John doesn't behold Revelation Babylon fallen and destroyed until verse 16. Do you notice that? Just observe this structural thing in the chapter. What happens next is not the fall of Babylon. That's not described till 16 and 17. What's in between, if you let your eyes just run down through that, what's in between, "Come, I will show you the judgment of Babylon," and the actual judgment of Babylon at the end of the chapter, is a lot of unmasking, a lot of exposure. This is a picture of what Babylon is actually really like. Only after that do we witness her demise. Why arrange it that way? Well, I don't know. There's no like pastoral cliff notes or end notes to the Bible that explain why it's written the way it is. You just have to, but I can imagine, and you can too, right? There are deep pastoral reasons why, very helpful personal reasons why. It'd be wise for John to expose what Babylon's like before he announces her demise, one of them being, we need more than the promise that Babylon will someday fall. right? We need to know how to resist her while she still stands. John wrote this vision 2,000 years ago, and Christians have lived in Babylon ever since. We need to know how to deal with her. And second, we need to see how she operates. Her power comes from seduction, not oppression. In fact, that's the implicit claim of this chapter. If I had to put Revelation 17 in one sentence, this would be it. When you see Babylon's corruption and her ultimate destruction, she loses all power of seduction. That's Revelation 17 in one sentence. When you see, that's what this book's meant to help us do, to see. It's so visual. It's like watching a movie in some ways. Very strange movie, but watching a movie. When you see Babylon's corruption and ultimate destruction, it completely defangs her powers of seduction. She can't get you if you see what she's really like. Now, in the rest of the paragraph, John gives us six symbolic descriptions to expose Babylon's true moral and spiritual character. In the rest of these verses, verses 1-6, all of this is meant for her glitz and glamour to give way in our souls to absolute revulsion and just go, how could she ever seduce anyone? That's what this is meant to do. Look at the first description at the beginning of verse 2. I'm just going to read almost like line by line and comment on these six features. 2a, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality. Just stop and think about that for a moment. Babylon seduces rulers into spiritual compromise. That's what that's describing. Kings of the earth, sexual immorality. Throughout scripture, sexual immorality is used as an image for idolatry. Babylon offers the rulers, the leaders, the key people on the planet. She offers them power, influence, luxury, prestige. And they gladly slip into bed with her to get all of that. That's what that's describing. She doesn't make these kings bow down to her. She just makes them want her. The rest of verse 2 shows the second quality. With the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. So there's two stages to this thing. She makes the leaders, the rulers, the kings of earth sleep with her, and the inhabitants compromise everything to have what she's offering. And the inhabitants of earth, the dwellers on earth, not the followers of the Lamb, the dwellers on earth in Revelation are the opposition people group to the followers of the Lamb. But the dwellers on earth move in the direction that the followers of the Lamb are tempted. The followers of the Lamb see through, but the dwellers on earth look at what she offers these rulers, these kings. She gives them wealth and pleasure to these idolatrous kings, and all the inhabitants of earth get drunk on that. They're like, oh, if I could have that, if I could have what she's given them, the intelligentsia, the celebrities, the athletes, the people at the pinnacle of every level, of every aspect of society, whatever your career, whatever your discipline, whatever industry or line of work you wish you could have, you could reach the top. She gives those people certain things, and the rest of the world goes, oh my goodness, if I could have that. And again, notice her strategy. She intoxicates, she entices. That's why she's called a prostitute, right? She dresses up what God calls evil until it looks irresistible. And then people trade away everything that God is for just a little sip of what she's offering. People become drunk on entertainment and luxury and sexual freedom and self-expression and wealth and comfort and distraction. That's what Babylon offers. And once you're drunk, you lose all ability to evaluate whether anything is good and true and beautiful. All you want is another drink. That's what the inhabitants of earth are getting from her. This is why Revelation repeatedly calls the saints to endurance, to spiritual sight, to see through. Because Babylon's greatest weapon is not Should I just say this? America's greatest weapon is not oppression. It is intoxication and seduction. I mean, we call it the American dream. What is that? Except offering you a sip of wine that has made the movers and shakers on earth so important, so powerful, so filled with pleasure, a life that's so desirable that it makes you drunk imagining it. We call it something that's not the name of a wine, but it's the name of a vision that we all wish we could have. And please understand, I'm not bagging on our country. It's my favorite one on the planet. I don't think there has ever been a better one. I mean that sincerely. It's just you couple up all of what it is that America implicitly offers with the human love of anything other than God, and you have the greatest rival God that humanity has ever produced. A reasonable, responsible way of living that produces all these benefits, and we make the issue about the benefits. We call it the American dream. And it's seduction. It's intoxication. Friends, love of the world is pictured in this passage as sexual immorality. That is not a common sin. It is the ultimate, most intimate betrayal. It's giving your heart, your desires, your whole self to something other than God. It's not what the followers of the Lamb do. It's what the dwellers on earth do. But it's what we're tempted toward. The third quality of Babylon, she's supported by an empire that assumes godlike status. Verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. We've been introduced to this beast earlier. Chapter 13 described it in a way that echoed all of the empire imagery of Daniel. And so there, in chapter 13 of Revelation, hearkening back to the Daniel imagery, we learned the beast stands for empire. Here in this chapter, if you look down a few verses, 10, 12, she has these horns and heads. Those are all kings. And Babylon, this seductive harlot, is riding on the beast that stands for empire and kings. The point is, I think, pretty clear. Babylon's seduction is empowered and protected by powerful political and demonic forces. This American dream, our government works hard to protect that thing. The beast is covered with blasphemous names. This is the same thing as in chapter 13. Why? Because think about this. Just stop objecting to my bagging on America, because I'm not trying to. I'm just trying to apply what appears so plain to me. Right here, this beast is covered with blasphemous names because every human empire eventually takes to itself what belongs only to God: moral authority, unquestioned allegiance, the promise of salvation, and a whole new source of identity. Is that not what America is promising? Is that not what every empire has ever offered? Friends, the beast says, in effect, you do not need God. I will protect you. I will feed you. I will define you. I will save you. This is what concerns me about a church that's overly connected to politics or a political process or political power. It's not the decisions. It's not the issues. I promise you, I care about those. What I don't want is a church that is being drawn toward that. Why? Because think about this. Christians in the first century who read this book, some of them must have thought, good grief, there's so many things about the Roman Empire that are so great, right? I mean, it offered roads, it established laws, it restrained chaos, it expanded trade, it protected cities, it advanced engineering beyond anything the world had seen. It created a level of order and prosperity that those people had never seen anywhere. Rome offered them all of that. And they must have said, some of them, is it really all that bad? Rome is the best empire we've ever known. Are there any modern empires you can put in the blank in place of Rome? I can think of one. Or a bunch. Rome felt so civilized, so safe, so stable. And that's exactly what made Babylon so dangerous, friends. Because history repeatedly shows how nations and cultures and churches drift toward the seduction of Babylon when they believe the godlike promises of the beast. Babylon rides on the beast. It rides on empires. And people fall in love with Babylon when they trust the promises of the beast. I'm just preaching what's in the passage. The fourth quality. Her excessive wealth linked to abomination and impurity. Look at verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup. Oh, but here's the unmasking. Full of abominations and impurities of her sexual immorality. John is stunned by her appearance. She's got purple and scarlet and gold, and she looks magnificent. And then he notices what's in the cup. Abomination and impurity. This is Revelation's great reversal. Babylon looks amazing and attractive and wonderful. And if you look close, what she's serving up will destroy you and everything precious to you. The world constantly trains us. Notice that imagery of motherhood. Babylon trains us. Did I get ahead? We'll get to that in verse 5, the motherhood agenda. Here, what I want to say is the way Babylon, this worldly system, is training us to associate wealth and glamour and influence with what's desirable. With what's really good. It looks all dressed up. It's wealthy. It's beautiful. This golden cup, these marvelous like clothes. Babylon like glitters externally, and internally it's rotten. Verse 5 is where this motherhood shows up, this motherhood thing. Look at that. The fifth quality, she's the mother of earth's abominations. On her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. Probably wearing some kind of a headband or even a crown that has that name on it. And again, you already know where I want to go. I want to talk about how Babylon is not merely sinful herself. She reproduces sin. She disciples the nations in her rebellion. That image of motherhood applied here is just absolutely revolting to me. Babylon's giving birth to more idolatry, more greed, more pride, more blasphemy, more lust. It's just what the world system does. It comes out of New York City and Hollywood and, yes, Denver itself, just producing more and more of this stuff. She trains us to worship all of these created things instead of the Creator. She shapes our instincts about the world and our assumptions and our whole worldview. If we will let her, she'll disciple us exactly in her image. She forms consciences and tells us what's right and wrong. This is why Christians must constantly be exposed to the Word of God. The sixth quality, she devours the saints. Verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs. And finally, the mask just comes off completely. And it shows us that she's drunk with the blood of the saints. This world system that opposes God eventually turns violent toward those who resist it. When Christians will not worship and admire what Babylon does, when they will not celebrate and compromise with Babylon, she hates them. And this has happened in every age and in almost every place around the world. Martyrdom, imprisonment, exclusion, mockery, slander, ridicule. Babylon tolerates anything except loyalty to the Lamb. She'll put up with whatever you want to say, whatever you want to do. I mean, whatever, whatever. Except declare that the Lamb is your Lord and guide. She won't handle that. Babylon still walks this earth, doesn't she? You see her in so many places and in so many ways. Sometimes she looks like Hollywood's glitz and glamour. sometimes endless luxury and addiction. Sometimes she looks like political movements that demand absolute allegiance. Sometimes she looks like sexual freedom detached from anything holy or marriage itself. Sometimes she looks like churches that have been reshaped to win cultural approval or have political power. Sometimes she looks like your phone that's discipling you with hours of exposure to everything that it offers. That's all Babylon. She still intoxicates. And Revelation says when you finally see her for who she is, she loses her seductive power. That's why I'm belaboring this. This is the first paragraph of this chapter. The rest I'm going to go through pretty quickly. The hard stuff. I mean, the stuff that you're curious about. Hey, explain these 10. I got no ideas. I'll just tell you now. What does it mean that the beast is an eighth, but he's one of the seven? I don't know. But I will tell you what I think is clear in that paragraph. So let's look to that. The power behind Babylon in this next paragraph, verses 6b to 14. Starts out like this, these first two verses. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. You can imagine why. John was just told he's going to see the judgment of Babylon, and he sees this splendid, amazing-looking, horrible prostitute who's not being punished at all. And he's like, what? And the angel explains, verse 7, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. Now, again, I don't know what all that means. It's just said three times in this chapter, which means it really matters. And it exactly parallels the history, the life arc, the redemptive history trajectory of the dragon, right? He was. And then there's a season where he's bound in the bottomless pit and is not. And then he rises from the bottomless pit and has a moment before he's thrown into the lake of fire forever. The beast seems to be both parodying God himself, the one who is and was and is to come, and doing it exactly like the dragon. The rest of verse 8, the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. Let me remind you of the relationship. The harlot is riding the beast. The beast, in one word, stands for power. The harlot, in one word, stands for pleasure. And that political power carries this seductive harlot around. And Satan does it in a way that isn't generative. He's not creating something new. He's just counterfeiting what God has. Divine power, divine authority, divine permanence, always around. An empire falls, it is not, and another one shows up. Verses 9 and 10. This calls for a mind with wisdom. Actually, let's go all the way to verse 13. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. Possibly an allusion to Rome, right? Sitting on seven, but not mountains, hills. Why mountains? Because empires are compared to mountains. And so yes, Rome, seven hills, but not just Rome, seven mountains, the number of fullness, all empires of all time. This harlot, Babylon, is sitting on these seven heads, which are seven mountains. And then here we go, apocalyptic literature, where the symbols keep shifting. Verse 10, there are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. If I can make any sense out of that, it's simply this. Seven is a series of fullness. You can't map that perfectly onto any of the Roman empires or emperors, any empires of the world. So my best effort, seven, the number of fullness, all the empires of all time. Most of them are done. Five have fallen. One is now. Always the case. And there's one more about to come. The great empire under the rule of the beast. I don't know what that's going to look like or when it's going to show up. But I think that's best I could venture what these seven kings are. That's what I think verse 11 means. As for the beast that was and is not, it's an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power. They're about to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand their power and authority over to the beast. So a whole coalition of world rulers who, at the time the beast comes to power, align themselves with him and for a moment look impressive. But the whole section is moving toward one great assurance. Look at verse 13, or excuse me, 14. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those with him are called and chosen and faithful. Not might conquer them, will. Why? Because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. There's no other. There are a bunch of little lords. There's one big capital L Lord. Bunch of little kings, real kings. There are real kings. There's only one who lays real claim to the title. It's him. The beast looks terrifying and Babylon looks irresistible. The nations unite in rebellion and Revelation keeps pulling our attention toward the throne and the Lamb. Jesus reigns. End of discussion. And notice where we show up in this chapter. I love this. The end of this verse. Those with him are called and chosen and faithful. We're not with the Lamb because we're stronger than the people with the beast. We're with the Lamb because he wanted us. We got called and chosen. And he kept us faithful to the end. And so we conquer all of this. Cannot take us down. Verse 14 feels to me like the climax of the chapter. You put a period on it, you sing a closing song, and you go home. And it's not. Because we haven't seen the judgment of the prostitute yet. That's what verse 1 promised. So 15 to 18, the last paragraph zooms out again and shows us how the prostitute goes down. How do all these seductive cultures die? What is it ultimately that takes down the harlot? Verse 15. The angel said to me, the waters you saw, where the prostitute is seated, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. These are willful participants all around the world who, verse 1 said, the harlot is sitting on waters, and then she rides the beast. Well, the waters are people everywhere. 16 and 17, look how she goes down. The 10 horns you saw, they and the beast, will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind, handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Total self-destruction. How? How does Babylon go down? Totalitarian government destroys secular culture. That's what happens at the end of all things. Doesn't sound like a kingdom I want to be part of. Right? Finally, whatever city you want to name, let's just call it Babylon. Finally, the head city of the whole society goes, I have had enough of Hollywood making statements, of politicians expressing their own contrary views, of rich people influencing elections around here. Done. I'm in charge. And at the end of all things, totalitarian power destroys secular pleasure. It's just one dictatorial hell. That's how Babylon goes down at the end of all things. And it makes sense, right? Because inherent within the seeds of evil are its own self-destruction, always, everywhere. That's how it always happens. Verse 18 identifies this woman. The woman you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. So I said the point of this whole chapter is when you see Babylon's corruption and ultimate destruction, she loses her power of seduction. But like, how does that apply directly to us? Well, let me wrap this up by giving our attention not to Babylon, but where the chapter ends with its focus, on God. Right? God is, I just want to point out two qualities of God that stand out so clearly here, his sovereignty and his wisdom. He is 100% in charge here, isn't he? I was so grateful. Peter stood right here and said, this chapter's crazy, this book is strange, it ends with God. That's exactly right. We see this seductive whore and this destructive beast and lots of powerful kings, and God takes them all out. No contest. Look again at verse 14. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. The Lamb wins. Friends, let's put all doubts to rest about this. God has not lost control of your life, or this church, or our country, or the world. All of them are precious to him. All of them. He's just letting his plan work out in ways that you never would, ever, ever would. But he's still in charge. Verse 17 tells us it's he that brings down Babylon. These kings, like totalitarian government, goes enough and destroys secular culture. But verse 17 tells us he does that. You see that? If God is sovereign, think about this. If God is sovereign over Babylon's destruction, then he's certainly sovereign over Babylon's success, isn't he? He decides how long she rides the beast. She continues her career seducing the foolish and slaying the faithful for as long as God chooses. She's still here because he wants her here. Don't know why. It's just his plan, his will, his choice. Friends, we know this. Her seduction will last not one moment longer than God intends, but it will not end one moment sooner than he wills either. He decides when Babylon falls, completely sovereign. But I want you to notice his wisdom as well. The astonishing thing in this chapter is not that Babylon falls, it's how she falls. The beast carries her, the kings support her, the nations admire her, and then the whole coalition suddenly destroys her. There's a lesson in that. I mentioned it, evil contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction, but that's not what John emphasizes here, is it? He gives us a totally different reason why this happens. Look again at 16. The 10 horns and beast will hate the prostitute and make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire, for God put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose. Do you ever wonder why leaders turn totalitarian and start to crush the people who are following them? I'm not exactly sure why it happens in every case, but someday the reason will be God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose. To me, this is one of the most comforting statements in this book. If there's one thing rebels don't want to do, it's fulfill the will of God. It's exactly what they're doing here, isn't it? He turns their hearts to be so angry at the whore that they shred her and leave her a pile of bones. And the lamb goes, that's what I was wanting. Exactly what I was angling toward. The very thing they resist, his will, is what he uses them to accomplish. What kind of power and wisdom does it take to pull that off? The same kind of power and wisdom that we saw on the cross, isn't it? 1 Corinthians 2, Paul writes, "We impart a secret hidden wisdom from God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of the age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." They had no idea what they were doing. And if they did, they wouldn't have done it that way. Judas betrayed Jesus, thinking he would stop the plan. The priests condemned Jesus, assuming that would end the problem. The Romans executed Jesus, believing that would finish him. Satan, the great serpent, struck the heel of Jesus, not noticing there was a crushing weight coming down on his own head. In every case, these powers destroyed themselves by the very act they thought would make them victorious. They destroyed themselves doing the thing they thought would help them win. That's power and that's wisdom, isn't it? Babylon thinks she's winning. The beast thinks he's invincible. It's only because they don't understand the hidden wisdom of God. Who would give his son to die so that people will come be part of his bride instead of adoring Babylon the harlot. Forgive me, but my friend Buff said to me one time, every sermon, the preacher's job is to rip off the covers to expose the whore that people have been sleeping with. Okay, I've never said that before because it's so yucky. But it kind of fits, doesn't it? Maybe I should quote C.S. Lewis instead of my friend Buff. C.S. Lewis captures this, how God does this so well in that first Narnia book. Susan and Lucy are talking to, they're talking to Aslan, and he's explaining his resurrection, the deeper magic from before time, that conquering power that was wrought in love, born in pain, and paid in sacrifice. Aslan says, when someone does that, when that happens, this deeper magic kicks in, the table will crack, and death itself will start working backward. That's what's happening here. This is the wisdom and power of our God, who doesn't just defeat evil, he makes evil defeat itself. I think that's so admirable. I can't not just worship him. Absolutely adore him. Trust him. Just persevere for another day, another week. Friends, if you see the true nature of Babylon's corruption, you won't fall prey to her seduction. But don't stop there. Behold your God, who uses every act of evil to drive history ever closer to the final triumph of the Lamb. Amen. Oh, Father, I pray for opened eyes and transformed hearts in the blaze of your glory that we see here in Christ, and save us from our sins. In Jesus' name I pray.